So, as we said, I'm going to be talking about let your poison be your cure. But before I go into that, I wanted to just tell you a bit of the story of how Badra and I have been dreaming this weekend into being together. We've not led anything together before, and it's been a very enjoyable process. And we started talking about co-leading this retreat back before Christmas. We had a conversation at the class at the end of November, very end of November, and the next morning Badra emailed me. And he said, it was good to see you last night. This is where my mind travelled to this morning. So this was on the back of our first conversation about the retreat. Mazes, mandalas and Dharma doors. The journey of return through the body. Wonder in the ordinary. Coming home to the heart. And then this quote from Eliot, which I think you mentioned yesterday. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. That particularly spoke to me. It's from one of my favourite passages of Eliot as well. At the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And he went on. I imagine tracing out a huge version of the Chartres maze on the Adishtana field, a pool at its centre, sewing jewels into cloaks, tales of self-banishment, Buddhas wrapped in rags, walking blindfolded to the high hill and a dressing up box. So this is the sort of gathering of these images and imagination. It's all here. It's not, don't take it literally. But this is part of the cooking that's gone into this retreat between us. And I replied, it took me a few days to reply, I hadn't been so well. And I said, what a rich crop of images your mind threw up, like treasures on a beach from the deep. I like the return journey to our true home theme. And it reminded me of Hakuin's song of meditation. Not knowing it is near, they seek it afar. What a pity. It is like one in the water who cries out for thirst. It is like the child of a rich house who has strayed away among the poor. So that was the beginnings of our conversation about this retreat. And, I went on actually, there was another bit. Now my mind, I said to Badra in this email, my mind is remembering a poem from the Merseysound collection. Some of you might remember it, 1960s poetry collection from the Liverpool poets. Adrian Henry, Roger McGough, Brian Patton. I said, I think it's a poem called Love from Arthur Rainbow. And it's got bits like, she's eating roses on toast with tulip butter. And there was an image of treasure beneath the front gate, which I think was the bit that kind of resonated with what Badra had been talking about. And I said to Badra, I'll see if I can find it. Well, Badra, I have found it now. I never got around to sending it to you. And I wanted to share it with you, because this was part of what started cooking when I was resonating with what Badra was talking about. So it is indeed called Love from Arthur Rainbow. I can't remember which of those three poets it's by, but never mind. In a villa called Much Bickering, in a street called Pleasant Street, living with her wicked parents, was a princess, small and neat. She wanted to be an artist, so off to college she went, and as long as she got a diploma, they considered it money well spent. One day she met a poet who taught her all about life. He walked her down to the station, then went back home to his wife. He came from the end of the rainbow. At least that's what she thought. The kind of love she wanted, the kind that can't be bought. But time and the last train to the suburbs killed the love that would never die. And he'll find another lover, and she'll sit at home and cry. Now she's reading through his letters in her small schoolteacher flat. Dusty paint tubes in the corner, worn out welcome on the mat. Oh, the day she met Arthur Rainbow, there were roses all over town. There were angels in all the shop windows and kisses, not rain, coming down. Now it's off to work every morning and back home for dinner at 8. For the gold at the end of the rainbow lies buried beneath her front gate. So those of you who have a good memory might realise that I didn't actually mention anything about heaven and Woolworths. Somewhere between heaven and Woolworths actually was a line from a different poem. And it was very much part of the same, in my mind, it was a whole conflation of that same era. It was a kind of magical, mystical 1960s, slightly psychedelic world that Arthur Rainbow came from. And this different poem had this wonderful stanza, somewhere between heaven and Woolworths, I live, I love, I scold. I keep kingfishers in their cages and goldfish in their bowls. I think these two particularly spoke to me because the house I grew up in was actually opposite the back entrance to Woolworths. We were sort of one street behind the high street. And so I think for me, probably, that idea, the treasure outside the front gate, it's definitely connected with Woolworths. Anyway. Yeah. But I think those lines also say a lot about the spiritual life and how we live the spiritual life. We don't have to look far for where we dig for gold. It's in that middle ground somewhere between heaven and Woolworths. But we do have to get out of the gate. We do have to actually go forth a bit, step outside of the known, the familiar. And we get on to the Dharma life, the journey of the Dharma life. And I was thinking about this talk the other day and I realised there was this image that I used to have about the Dharma life, and I'm sure I'm not alone in it. So I thought I'd just evoke that and just see how many of you it resonates with as we tune into this idea of the journey. So I was thinking, yeah, some people come across the Dharma like stumbling on an immense jewel that radiates light. The path shines out unmistakably. They step onto it, not unlike the fabled yellow brick road, and tread steadily and surely onwards. They sit in meditation and calm and tranquility. They watch their breath and are quickly filled with great and luminous stillness. They practice the Metta Bhavana meditation and discover a great warm light radiates from their hearts to all beings. Unwaveringly, they remain calm in all circumstances, ethical under all conditions. Their energy never flags, and they enjoy a steadily deepening wisdom while retaining an unshakable mindfulness and equanimity. So, do you know anyone like that? I don't. But I think that is what I thought when I started. I had some idea like that. That was what it was going to be like. Bhante's written a fantastic poem, which I'm not going to quote this morning, but I'd recommend it. It's a sonnet. Some think the Buddha way, as though macadamised, it runs here from Nirvana. By 10 tonight, you'll be there, good people in the light. I recommend it. Anyway, so I was thinking, oh, my actual experience of practising the Dharma, the journey of the spiritual life, actually resonates much more with another poem that I love, from the Irish poet Louis MacNeice. It's a poem called Thalassa, which is that's the Greek word for sea, and it's very much evoking the journey of a sea, the image of a sea voyage. And that image of the Dharma life, the Dharma and the sea, have always been very connected in my mind, and I think the image of being free sailing on the sea is a real evocation of freedom for me. So what Louis MacNeice says is, run out the boat, my broken comrades. Let the old seaweed crack. The surge, burgeon, oblivious of the last embarkation of feckless men. Let every adverse force converge. Here we must needs embark again. Run up the sail, my heartsick comrades. Let each horizon tilt and lurch. You know the worst. Your wills are fickle, your values blurred, your hearts impure, and your past life a ruined church. But let your poison be your cure. Put out to sea, ignoble comrades, whose records shall be noble yet. Butting through scarps of moving marble, the narwhal dares us to be free. By a high star, our course is set. Our end is life, put out to sea. So it's quite unashamedly heroic about that kind of, yep, you turn again, you go out the gate, out of the gate again, you put out to sea. And this word narwhal, some of you probably know it, I don't know if you all will. A narwhal is a very particular kind of whale that dives very, very deep in the ocean, has a single tusk, and in some cultures is said to have magical properties. So it's this sense of it's a being who really dives to the depths and dwells in the depths. And I do love that sense of this poem gives of setting out, going forth, beginning again, and we begin again and again. Not with any sense of being a perfect being on a perfect quest, but it's this is who I am, warts and all. This is what I've got to work with. This is my body. This is a set of samskaras, the habit patterns Badra was talking about yesterday. This is my karma vipaka, the fruits of my former actions. And all that is the fuel and the raw material of the journey. Let your poison be your cure. So that brings me to my theme. And with the language of poisons, this poem completely meets the Dharmic language of poisons. So it's very traditional in the Buddhist literature to talk about the poisons. Badra's just been doing this series on the Wheel of Life on Tuesday nights, and at the hub of the wheel we've got the three poisons: craving, hatred and delusion. They're the three root poisons, and they absolutely drive all our dukkha. They're right at the heart of things. And there are also two more poisons in a traditional list of five. There's pride or conceit, and there's envy, which has a lot of fear behind it. And the thing about these poisons is that they all have a massive amount of energy in them. They are raw materials. They can be the fuel for the journey. It's not that we kind of put them to one side and then go off and have this perfect experience. They are what the path is made of, in a way. Coming into relationship with these aspects of ourselves, these energies. They contain the seeds of our awakening, the energy of our awakening. And some of you were there in January when I did a series of talks on imagination. And we talked about this in the week when we talked about the Vajrayana phase of Buddhism. And we talked about the image of the Vajra. I happened to find one in the cupboard here. So this is a diamond thunderbolt. And it's an image of a unstoppable force meeting an immovable object. And the symbolism traditionally is that one end you've got the five poisons, and the other end you've got, well, often it's described as the five wisdoms, but you could, in this case, we're actually going to be talking about the five spiritual faculties, which are another very central, very important teaching. So there's a relationship between the poisons and the spiritual faculties, the positive qualities of the enlightened mind. And this is a round bit in the middle, which is where all the transformation happens. It's the cauldron, the crucible of transformation. And it's really worth knowing and bearing in mind that whatever our poison is, there's a quality that has an affinity with it. There's a certain kind of energy. I'm going to talk about this in a bit more detail later. Between these unskillful habits, poisons that we bring onto the path, and the skillful ethical qualities that can grow out of them when we practice. So it's very important to know your poisons. I think greed, hatred, and ignorance are probably ones that we talk about quite often. They're quite familiar. The other two in the list perhaps are a bit more unfamiliar. So I'm going to say a little bit about them. So there's pride or conceit. Pride or conceit. And this is very much a kind of state of mind that arises when we start comparing ourselves with other people. Oh, I'm better than her, and oh, I can do this fantastic thing, and I really need to make sure other people know about it. It's not a healthy pride that is just knowing what we can do and being confident, metaphor in ourselves. There's that sense of measuring, there's that sense of, actually, there's a sense of inadequacy, so we're sort of needing to big ourselves up a bit by comparison. I was thinking about an experience of this in my own life, and quite a few years ago, I spent a year working for a cycling charity, doing their admin. And I used to find myself a lot of the time comparing myself with the guy who's running it, and often finding him wanting and thinking how well I was doing with what I was doing. One day, it was a really, really stupid thing. We were moving an office from upstairs to downstairs, and I caught myself absolutely in the middle of it. I was halfway down the stairs carrying a box of things, and I realised I was carefully enumerating all the things I'd organised so well, how thoroughly I was making all this happen, how smooth it was, and thinking, and he wouldn't have done it like that. And it had that kind of, as it happened, I was like, oh, where did that come from? Oh, yes, that's definitely pride. Okay. But there's another side to it. There's also the complete opposite of that, which is, it's a different kind of conceit, which is actually not having a healthy sense, a realistic sense of yourself and your capabilities and what you can do. It's that sort of ever so humble, I couldn't possibly, not me, I'm just a lowly worm. And that's pride as well. That's still comparison. You're still thinking, you're comparing yourself with somebody else, thinking you're not so good, you're not up to it. It's as much of a hindrance, it's as much of a poison. And I often think of Manjushvara, who many of us knew, a very dear friend who died about 6 years ago. And it was something he was very clear about. He had a very positive sense of his own self-worth. And he was very clear about how having not really taking up your space, if you like, or not really taking ownership of your good qualities is actually a poison as well. So he wrote a novel before he died, and I ended up with a draft of it. And I just wanted to read you what he wrote, because he has a character in this novel, a Buddhist monk. It's interesting, it's set in Bristol. And there's a Buddhist monk who lives in a house over the suspension bridge. And the main character goes to meet this monk, and he receives this teaching. And the monk says, "We shouldn't be shy of our own qualities. It ill becomes us. It is no less a form of conceit than boastfulness." So I'm going to read that again, not least because Manjushvara always read things twice. "We shouldn't be shy of our own qualities. It ill becomes us. It's no less a form of conceit than boastfulness." So it's worth bearing in mind, thinking about this poison of pride and conceit. It goes both ways. There's a middle way. And then the fifth poison is the poison of envy or jealousy. And one of the interesting things about this is it's actually a combination of craving and hatred together. There's something we don't want and something we want, and they're both right in there. In the scriptures, it's described as highly perturbed. So it's very anxious, it's very fearful. We're worried that we're going to lose something, we're going to lose power, we're going to lose a person that we're attached to. Sexual jealousy is very much in that realm, or a kind of sticky attachment to people. And when Sangharakshita's talking about this in Know Your Mind, which, by the way, is a very good book, Know Your Mind is like one of those medical dictionaries for the poisons. You can sort of look up what you think you've got one day and have a look what he's got to say about it. And find some things you didn't even dream you had until you read it. So, yeah, Know Your Mind, very good. But one of the things he says in there is there's not only that wanting to control and hold on to a person because you don't want to lose them, in this case of, you know, sexual jealousy or this kind of sticky attachment to a friend. But there's also that fear of losing their positive regard of oneself. It's like you're dependent on your lover or your friend's view of you, opinion of you. You're kind of standing in the light that they shed on you, and if that light were to be taken away, then you'd be depleted, diminished. In a way, it would take away part of yourself. So it's very interesting to reflect on this. Those roots, there's that craving and aversion right in there. So there's a lot of energy in envy. Mm. So those are the poisons. So what about the cure? Well, when Badra and I were talking about the retreat, we were talking about kind of classic Dharma for the journey, and we both felt that the teaching on the five spiritual faculties is a really, really helpful toolkit for the journey. That was how we started out talking about it. See, we had this original idea, it's all about the journey. Badger was going to talk about the return journey, I'm going to talk about the toolkit. I think originally I was going to talk first, and anyway, you know, discarded understandings. We find ourselves here with the toolkit of the five spiritual faculties. And they are a way of transforming the poisons. So why are they important? Well, it's something that the Buddha taught again and again and again. They appear loads of times. The actual word for faculty is Indriya, which is connected with Indra, who is, in Indian mythology, he's the king or the ruler of the gods. So the Indriyas are the ruling qualities. They're kind of the king qualities of enlightenment, if you like. And they appear again and again in the Pali scriptures. There's a very fat collection called the Samyutta Nikaya, and they've got a whole section of their own in there. And one of the numerous lists of very important things in the Pali canon are the 37 Bodhipakkhyas, or the wings of enlightenment. So there's 37 of these things, and these five actually get to be in there twice, which is interesting. They're so important, they get to appear twice, and there's a reason for that. You've got these five faculties, which I'll tell you about in a minute, and you can use them, you can cultivate them, you can use them as a practice, as a faculty that you can develop. But once they really become established, and once you've really transformed those poisons into those faculties, they become what is known as balas, which means powers. And I was thinking, oh, this is a bit like the superpowers that superheroes have. You know, it's like, I love, one of the ways I love to think about the Bodhisattva ideal, that ideal of, you know, wanting to do what one can to benefit all beings, to save all beings. It's a really heroic ideal, and it's like, On The Secret, we're all training to become these dharmic superheroes. And you need the superpowers. And actually, these poisons that we've got, they're just energy. They're energy that's got locked into a particular knot or a particular formation. We can transform them, and they can become these superpowers, secret powers. So, yeah, so these five spiritual faculties. So we'll get to the nitty-gritty now of what are the five spiritual faculties and how can we transform the poisons. What is this relationship between the poisons and these spiritual faculties? So we'll start with hatred. So hatred can transform into wisdom, or to put it another way, cultivating wisdom can transform the poison of hatred. And Bhante talks in, there's a section in the Essential Sangharakshita where he's quoting the Buddhist scholar Dr. Khonsa, who was a very wise man and incidentally was also known for being very angry and irritable. Anyway, and he says there's an affinity between hatred and wisdom. And this affinity is that what's behind hatred is this desire to destroy, to eradicate. it's a very unskillful application of that energy. But there's this desire to eradicate. But actually we can take that energy that wants to destroy and eradicate, and we can actually have as its object, not a person, not a thing, we can actually have ignorance as its object. We can really seek to use that energy to cut through ignorance, to destroy ignorance, to get off that endless wheel, that endless round. In a way, the energy of hatred is a great big no to, often, you know, and it's unskillful, it's no to a person, no to something that we feel aversion to. But if we didn't feel some aversion to being in that endless round of samsara in the wheel of life, we wouldn't say that no, we wouldn't set out on the spiritual quest. And we can practice with wisdom to gradually also work away at anger, to see through, to understand, as I'm explaining now, that anger is just energy, and the objects of our anger, they're conditioned beings. They're actually a whole bunch of different conditions that have come together. That person who's really irritating you, there's a reason for that. The more you study and practice the Dharma, you cultivate metta, you come to understand, there's this bunch of things that have happened to that person through their life, maybe through lifetimes. There's a reason why they're really irritating me. You come to develop enough wisdom to know yourself and know, actually, I'm getting angry because that's hitting a really old button, a samskara, like Badra was talking about yesterday. You come to understand. As you come to understand, you start to unravel the knot of that anger, which is just, it's like a child's no to start with. It's like, I just don't want to know. No. Ugh. And you sort of open it up with wisdom. You look with the eyes of wisdom and you start to see people, the world, differently. And all those things that used to come together and create anger, you understand them, there's more space. And we cultivate wisdom through studying the Dharma, through listening to talks, through reflection on our own, reflecting on conditioned co-production in our lives. This is something Bhante talks about a lot. Somebody once said to him, how could I become more like you? How could I become more wise? Reflect on conditioned co-production in your life. Reflect on conditionality. What's going on here? What conditions are playing out? Study groups are a fantastic way to develop wisdom. They also give you plenty of opportunity at working with ill will, irritation, you know, that's the grit, that's the heat, that's the, when something really bugs you and you can stay in there, not letting go of that energy, but also having a kindly awareness around it, you can really cut through some views, which are the very things which are tying you down. And of course you can meditate on the Dharma, that's the deepest level of wisdom, the three levels of wisdom. You hear the Dharma, you reflect on the Dharma, and you meditate on the Dharma. So yeah, that energy of anger can really help you to see through the objects of your hatred, let them be transformed. And in a way, there's a quote from a Chinese text called the Sin Sin Ming, and it says, and then things ceased to exist in the old way. So you haven't actually destroyed anything, and actually from a wisdom perspective, they never existed in the first place anyway. But they cease to exist in the same way. They're not there, so you've got that wisdom. Okay, so we'll go from hatred to its opposite, craving. And the spiritual faculty that helps us to work with craving and the power that can come from transforming craving is faith. Faith. So we're talking here about the Buddhist understanding of faith, not a Christian idea of blind faith. It's a very different understanding in the Buddhist tradition. And for those of you who have not come across this before, we often talk about faith in Buddhism as consisting of intuition. You have an idea, you have a sense, an intuition that something is possible. You use reason. Reason is not excluded from faith in the Buddhist tradition. But importantly, the third one is experience. You reflect on your experience. So you have an intuition, you reason about it, you try something out in your experience, And then you just keep reflecting, and you can. It's a cultivation of faith that's very much with your rational mind taken with you, not left behind. But the rational mind isn't ruling. It's about your heart and your mind, which in Buddhism aren't two anyway. And what's in craving? So this affinity between craving and faith, they share the energy of wanting, of longing. In an unskillful way, craving is wanting stuff, wanting people, wanting food, wanting money, it's wanting material things. I think when it's purified and transformed into that ethical longing, it's a longing. It's a longing for nirvana, it's a longing for freedom, it's a longing for freedom from suffering. So we can refocus that longing. We can practice in such a way we can refocus the energy of that longing on an object that's actually going to be satisfying. And we do that through practicing metta, through devotion, through puja, chanting, bringing to mind the Buddha. We can bring to mind a felt sense of being in the presence of the Buddha with all his qualities. That sense of the presence of the Buddha can give us faith. And something that is particularly uniquely stressed in our tradition is we can cultivate faith through friendship. And how that works is that actually when we really see the Dharma, when we really catch the Dharma, it's when it's embodied in an actual living human being and somebody that we've got a connection with. Then you see the Dharma come to life. You actually come into relationship with the person, you come into the relationship with the Dharma as it's living through that person. It's not just two-dimensional, black and white, on the page, entirely seen through the filters of your habitual way of looking at things. When you're in relationship with people, you start to open your heart more, and the Dharma can get in more. So friendship and faith is a very important connection. And ultimately, the Buddhist word for faith is Shraddha, and it means to place the heart upon, to place the heart upon. And there's this opening of the heart, which ultimately opens to everything. In the Mahayana tradition, there's this beautiful imagery that the whole mundane world can transform into a pure land. It's not that you go somewhere else and it's somewhere else. It's this very place, the lotus paradise, as Hakuin said, this very place, the lotus paradise. But we learn to see differently. Bhante talks about you don't see new things with old eyes. You actually see the old things with new eyes. You can see with the eyes of faith. If you cultivate faith through those practices that I've just been talking about, then actually the world starts to look different to you. Your experience of the world is different. So the third poison, ignorance. Ignorance transforms into mindfulness, or the practice of mindfulness can wear away at the poison of ignorance. And one of the things I've been reflecting on quite a lot this last year is it's often interesting to reflect on the etymology of words, what the actual bits of words mean. And if you think about ignorance, it's ignorance. You're actually ignoring things. You're just not paying attention. You're letting things slip by. You're not actually really noticing what's actually really there. And actually, that's deeply unsatisfying. When we're not mindful, we let the world go by in a sort of grey haze. I don't know how many of you have experienced depression. I have experienced depression, and there's a kind of grey film that comes out because we're just not able to let in the world. And it's interesting that we have these mindfulness-based approaches now to helping people work with depression, because actually, yeah, you're actually coming into experience, into relationship with the texture, the details of life and experience, the vividness. I expect everybody has had some experience. It's particularly strong when you've been on retreat and you're practicing meditation, you're practicing a lot of mindfulness, and you really start to notice the details of the world They really start to come to life. A friend of mine did a very intensive meditation retreat, and each day she was looking at the plant in the entrance hall, and she started to notice it in more and more detail. And then one day she just noticed that there were these little tiny dots around the edge of each leaf, and it was like more and more this plant, she was getting more and more of a sense of its energy and its vividness. And actually she moved out of that phase, and then much later on she lost that. She actually couldn't see that detail. So it's like the world comes into a vividness which becomes its own fascination. And it transforms that poison of ignoring, because there's a turning towards, there's a coming into relationship with a much more subtle sense of the world. So the Buddha taught loads about practicing mindfulness, and he taught these four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, something Badra was talking about and evoking, you know, very beautifully last night with that reflection. Mindfulness of the body. We practice the mindfulness of the breathing. Mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of thoughts, and ultimately mindfulness of reality. Again, it's reflecting on the nature of reality, on conditioned co-production, on praticca samuppada. Mindfulness transforms ignorance. So we'll come back to now pride and conceit, as I was talking about earlier. And they transform into a quality that it's very difficult to translate well into English. It's this word samadhi. Many of you will be familiar with it. And I think in early translations, it just used to get translated as concentration, which is a bit rubbish, really. Because concentration, you get this image of somebody probably sitting at an exam desk kind of getting... And it's definitely not that. It's definitely not that. So sometimes it's translated as meditation. But that's not entirely satisfactory either, because what it actually describes is this incredibly delightful state where our energies start to become unified. We get absorbed. We get absorbed in meditation, and our energies start to come together. The language of dhyana is... a way that the Buddhist tradition describes this process of us getting more absorbed. The Buddha taught these beautiful images for what can happen when we let our energies start to unify. So he had this image, it's like soap powder mixing with water to start with, that sense of energies integrating. It's like a spring bubbling up in a lake, energy within water. It's like a lotus that is in the water, but it's completely suffused by the water. There's a very subtle felt sense. And samadhi describes these higher levels of consciousness that we can, or deeper levels of consciousness that we can go into in meditation. And they have a very particular quality. They have this quality of appreciation. There's a quality of appreciation which... we can also experience off the cushion, often in nature. We'll get fascinated and absorbed. We really see a tree or a flower or a beautiful landscape. And it will take us out of ourselves in a certain kind of way, so that we're not concerned about me, I, the pride, the conceit. I'm not comparing myself with this tree. I'm not trying to do anything. Actually, in a way, it's almost like I'm arrested by this beauty. And it's not only beauty in nature, it's beauty in art, in music, in poetry. Those times when you're watching, listening, seeing something, and actually you lose that sense of, oh, here I am, here's me, I. This pride, this conceit, it just falls away. So we can cultivate samadhi, this unification of energies. Obviously through meditation is one way, but also through the appreciation of beauty. And again, it's something quite particular to our tradition that Sangharakshita stressed, that an appreciation of the arts can really help to waken up, and the use of our imagination can waken up this capacity to appreciate, and that gathers and unifies our energies. There's a beautiful poem that evokes this by the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa, to be great, be whole. Do not exaggerate or leave out any part of you. Put all you are into the least of your acts. Just as in each lake with its lofty light, the whole moon shines. And I think that line, put all you are into the least of your acts, that describes this really beautiful way in which everything that we do can be an aesthetic experience. The washing up, the tidying up, the whatever it is that you're doing, there's a way of doing it where you're not just doing it to get the job done. You're actually doing it with an aesthetic quality to it. Yeah, put all you are into the least of your acts. And then the final poison to look at, envy and fear. Well, as I said, envy is a combination of anger and craving. So there's a hell of a lot of energy in there. So it's probably not surprising to discover that the spiritual faculty that it transforms into is virya, or energy in pursuit of the good. So this is another case of you take what's in that poison, that envy, and recognising that there's fear. There's a lot of energy in fear and anxiety, and all that we can actually direct to be energy in pursuit of the good. We can repurpose it, we can upcycle it. We can reinvest that energy in a bigger vision rather than just wanting to stop somebody getting control of our project if it's a work situation. There's a kind of... No, that's too much of a digression. I won't go there. Nearly. Let's stick with that example I had, you know, the jealousy aspect. It's like we put all that energy into that worrying about the fact that the person we fancy is going to go off with somebody else, or the person we've been in a relationship with for a long time is going to remove their positive regard. It's like, wow, there's loads of energy there. What about if we took that and we actually directed that energy to a true refuge rather than a false refuge? It's pretty radical. And it's working with recognising that the fear is a loss. We fear a loss of power. We fear... Banti has this lovely phrase. I can't remember where it's from. He talks about us being a fragile ego in a sea of threat. A fragile ego in a sea of threat. And actually, if we can just gradually let go of that sense of the fragile ego, which we can do by having stronger connections, one of the classic ways of rousing and engaging our energy is to work, and to work with other people in the Sangha to create. What we've got here, Adhisthana, is created on that basis. People coming together, putting their energy in to the service of the good, the service of the Dharma, the service of the Sangha. And when we work together in teams in that way, when we work together in the centre doing projects, we bring our energy together. We're not keeping it separate. We're not being envious of somebody else. We're not kind of guarding it. We're actually putting our energy into that same stream. And then what happens is actually there's a greater energy that kind of joins that. Banti talks about it being as if there were a suprapersonal force. There's something that is more than all of us that can arise when we come together open-heartedly, and we're using our energy in the direction of the three jewels, you could say. It's a mysterious thing. I think if you had some experience of Sangha, you've had some, might be a little quiet taste of that. These things aren't always great big huge experiences. They can be like shy birds in the forest, a kind of, ooh, something going on here. But there's that sense of, ooh, I'm lending my energy, giving my energy with others, and that can be transformative. And that's another thing that's been a particular emphasis of Sangharakshita in his presentation of the Dharma, that working together is a revolutionary thing to do. And it doesn't just mean working together in the sense of a job. It means coming together as a team, as any bunch of people like us planning the retreat, you doing the washing up together, whatever it is, we've got... We're we're creating a Pure Land in a way. We've got an end in mind that we all want to grow and develop. We all want to create a transformed world. So that energy of envy can transform into virya, energy in pursuit of the good. So that's a little tour of the five poisons and their relationship with the five spiritual faculties. And just to recap, you can kind of approach from either end. You can practice wisdom as a way of working with that energy of anger. But there is another way, which is very interesting, which very much comes from the tantric tradition, which is this recognition that actually, if you really develop a strong meditation practice that is full of metta, full of positive emotion, as well as full of awareness, it's like you create this crucible, and you can sit with an awareness, say, of that anger in this crucible. And it is like the flames of transformation will arise. In the dedication ceremony on Friday night, there's that line, may the flames that transmute samsara into nirvana arise. And it's like when you've really built a strong crucible in meditation practice, you sit. And if you really sit with these strong things, it's like sitting in the fire. But there's that sense of there's a heating up, there's a purification, there's a transformation. And that's where the poison can turn into the power. It's purified. All the unskillful aspects burn off. But there's also a more approachable way, shall we say. So, what we're going to do now is turn to page 12. I wanted us to look at the whole map of the five spiritual faculties together, and I'm going to need a bit of help with this. Could I have some volunteers to help me? Now, let's just think. That way is the way the sun sets, more or less. So that would be the western way. That way would be the blue. And so, that is the north. Could somebody throw out the southern round, please? So here's something in true Blue Peter fashion that I prepared earlier. So, great. Yeah. Could you pull the eastern realm out a bit so the centre's a bit bigger? So what we've got, for anyone who can't see, is we've got white in the middle, red, green, blue and yellow. Some might be ringing bells for some of you. So right in the middle, we've got ignorance, right at the hub. Ignorance transforming into mindfulness. So the spiritual faculty of mindfulness, right in the middle. And then we talked about hatred transforming into wisdom. So that goes in the green section. And then we've got, craving transforming into faith, which goes in the red section. We have pride or conceit transforming into samadhi, that is so good. Aesthetic appreciation, unification of energy in the yellow section. And then we've just been talking about envy and fear behind it, transforming into energy. So that goes into this southern realm. Now they actually go that way round, because they are a bit like petals on a flower, pointing into the middle. So, what we've got here is an image of another kind of vajra. We've got this kind of vajra. Where is it? Here it is. This is a single vajra, transforming the energies into poisons. There's also my pocket. if I can get that. A double vajra, which is a crossed vajra, which has a phenomenal amount of energy in it, as you can imagine from all the things we've just invoked and talked about. And one of the ways of understanding this symbol is it's a map of what, in Buddhist cosmology, it's a map of what the world stands on. The world actually stands, rests on the fish of the vajra. It's all the energy, but it's all patterned and it's all relating. And interestingly, this particular vajra is currently, he currently lives, well, actually lives in Jwalamalani's house, because it's the Vishva vajra, it's called, the double vajra, which is the symbol that is passed from one chair of the Bristol Buddhist Centre to the next. It's the ritual object. And it's quite interesting, I think, because I think part of the function of the chair is that they have this vision of the whole mandala and what it rests on, all this energy, all these faculties. So there's a couple more things to say. There are ways in which these faculties come in pairs. The central one is always in the centre. You can't have too much mindfulness. But if you tend too much in the direction of, say, wisdom, you also need to cultivate faith. If you have way too much energy, but you haven't got that kind of samadhi, that kind of unification of energy, you're going to get out of balance. So these faculties need to be balanced. It may well be that we feel more drawn to one, which is great. We all have our own way into the mandala. I very much went in through the blue realm, had loads of energy, just wanted, done with samsara, had enough. And actually, I had to put loads of time and energy into really cultivating faith, lots of metta. So we often need to cultivate the one that's at the opposite to the one that we naturally feel drawn to. And a little note in terms of us as a Sangha, often we have a preferred home base, like, well, let's say, wisdom. And it may be that somebody that we're experiencing quite a lot of difficulty, actually, it might be that their home base, what we feel at home, is over here. And you get into this kind of, it's like, oh, we're just coming at it from different directions. There's nothing wrong. Yeah. So it's important to remember this when you're reading Dharma books as well, because different faculties are emphasised at different times. And Bhante says, if a teaching emphasises, for example, the importance of energy, you shouldn't conclude that according to that teaching, energy is the most important thing. What you should conclude is that the person that teaching was being given to in the first place needed to cultivate energy. So you're given what you need to counter. If you're very lazy, you need a teaching on energy. If you're very full of ignorance, you need mindfulness. One of them will be stressed. So this could be an interesting thing to talk about in your groups. You could talk about which ones most appeal to you, or which ones you feel most questioning and aversion towards. And also, yeah, think about for yourself, think about your friends in the Sangha, and bearing in mind also there's a sense in which it can be that the wisdom side appeals more to intellectual types, the faith side appeals more to emotional heart types, samadhi can appeal more to introverts, energy can appeal more to extroverts. So good to be aware of that. And tonight in the puja, we're going to be taking this image of the five spiritual faculties and taking it into a multi-level, multi-dimensional realm, because there are these archetypal figures who sit, as many of you know, in each of these coloured segments. It's like there's an archetypal Buddha for each of these qualities of the historical Buddha's enlightenment. So there's the yellow Buddha, Ratnasambhava, in the southern realm, the red Buddha, Amitabha, in the west, the green Buddha, Amoghasiddhi, in the north, the blue Buddha, Akshobhya, in the east, and in the centre this really mysterious white Buddha Vairochana. So I won't say more about that now, but if any of you would like to join me in the library after lunch, I'll have a whole bunch of materials if you feel inclined to make an offering for the puja tonight. It may be that you want to make an offering of the poison that you want to transform. It may be that you want to write something. I've got little cards. It's quite good when we do a ritual like puja to really think, oh, what in myself am I wanting to bring to the puja? What am I wanting to transform? And it might be moving towards an aspiration, or it might be something that you want to let go of. You want to place at the foot of the Buddha and let go of. So that's what we'll be doing tonight. So, in a way, each time we do a puja, it's a kind of going forth. We'll be stepping forward, we'll be stepping. We actually come and walk towards the Buddha, we're stepping towards the ideal. We're stepping out of the front gate. It's not very far, but it's a big step. So, thank you.